Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hi, friends, and welcome to the Papaya Podcast. I'm your hostess, trying her mostest, Sarah Nicole, and each week I'm going to be dishing out some sweetness mixed in with some seeds of wisdom or something like that. So get ready to get inspired, get candid, get real, because we are all in this digital space together. Today we have on former Comedy Central exec Tara Schuster, who is now an incredible author of two books. The first one in 2020, which was Buy Yourself the Fucking Lilies, and her latest book, Glow in the Fucking Dark. She has been very recognized for her written work and her works on self-care and mental health, and I'm really excited to hear a lot more about how we can adopt glowing in the fucking dark, because I think a lot of us could use that right about now. So please welcome Tara to the show. Tara, so nice to have you on. So nice to see a bright, happy face on a Monday. Tell us a little bit about who you are.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. First off, I'm a listener, so this is very fun for me.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Honestly, I saw the title of your book and I was like, yep. We're having her on.
Yep, we get it. We're on the same vibe. So I was an executive at Comedy Central. Totally 100% in the entertainment realm. I ran shows like Key and Peele, the sketch comedy show. I worked with David Spade. I had this big entertainment job. But nobody knew that I was severely anxious, depressed, dealing with suicidal ideation, all the fun stuff, you know, because I was so good at work. I was so good. I climbed the corporate ladder. I was one of the youngest people ever to be vice president of talent and development. And it was all because I had had a neglected, psychologically abusive childhood where external validation was all I had, basically, you know, so it had gotten me through school, all APs and A's in high school. Oh, and then I'm going to make it to this Ivy League college. And wow, now I made it to the fast track to executive. But oh my God, I'm completely melting down. And in New York, I lived in New York at the time, you would find me just the girl uncontrollably weeping on the subway. You know, like I was
But it ended up working in comedy. Totally adds up.
Yeah. Right. And so I know I felt like I was living in an episode of Broad City most of the time. But I would, you know, I'd be in the boardroom giving this major presentation and then I would exit and just fall apart. And, you know, might have kept going that way, except I hit rock bottom on my 25th birthday. I drunk dialed my therapist, threatening to hurt myself. And that was a real wake-up call. You know, I was so ashamed of myself and so scared, you know, that I had become this out of control. And on that day, I decided, you know what, it's time to get real. I didn't really have parents, you know, we were fed. I was privileged in many ways, but I was not parented. It's time to stop saying I should be better, because in my mind, I thought, well, I didn't have the worst childhood of all time. So who am I to complain? This is stupid. I'm stupid. This is silly. But the problem with dismissing myself that way and saying, oh, other people had it so much worse, I should be better. Well, I wasn't helping, quote unquote, other people, and I wasn't helping myself. I was just miserable. And so I decided I have got to take care of myself. I've got to be my own parent. I've got to reparent myself. I didn't have wise mentors to go to. I didn't have anyone to ask for help. So I just started a Google Doc because that's what I used at work. I thought, okay, this is going to be a work project. I'm going to start a Google Doc. It's going to have all my questions. What are values? What are principles? What are vegetables? Genuinely, what are they? Which one should I be eating? And I just attacked it for 5 years. For 5 years, I observed how the parents of my friends interacted, at family dinners. Like,
wow.
Yeah. Nobody's screaming at one another. Interesting. Maybe family isn't a curse. Those types of things. I did it for 5 years. The Google Doc ended up being 600 pages.
Whoa.
Yeah. It was like aside from having a full-time job, being my own parent was my other side of full-time job. And that's when I decided to write my findings into my first book, Buy Yourself the Effing Lilies. But so it was never, so for anybody who's meeting me for the first time, it was never like, I'm going to become a self-help writer. This is my passion and my plan. No, I was 100% a corporate executive with a stressful full-time ass job. And I realized I can't live this way. There has to be something. And once I had sort of realized, oh, I have this offering, like, I wish someone had held my hand. I wish someone had given me practical tips that, my books are not, therapy is amazing. I go to therapy. Therapy is very expensive. It's hard to find a good therapist. So I try to take really big concepts that I've learned about, break them down into practical little rituals that anyone could do today for free to take better care of themselves. So that's sort of my deal.
One thing that you said that I think is really important to sort of go back on for a second is the fact that you didn't feel like it was bad enough. And I experienced that in therapy. I remember one of the first times I went and I kept like excusing away my experiences because it wasn't as bad as I had seen in movies, or it wasn't as bad as I had heard could be. I've heard friends do this too, where they are struggling in a certain arena of something, but they're like, but at least it's not that. This pain Olympics that we sort of put ourselves in with each other, and it works against us every single time, whether we, see somebody struggling with something and we say to them, at least it's not this. And then also how we minimize our experiences to ourselves that put us into a situation of not getting better. We're just stuck with, it's not victim mentality. It's like weirdly opposite of that. Like, I'm not victim enough mentality. And it really is a strange place for so many people, especially when it comes to, mental health, abuse situations, understanding their childhood traumas, whatever that might be. I just thought that was really interesting that you had said that you even felt that you had minimized it for yourself. Moving into that, because I think a lot of people, and I know therapy has been normalized now, but even with therapy, a lot of people feel like they're not sick enough, or they are sick at all, or that they, there's this idea of what somebody looks like that goes to therapy, and it's like it needs to be completely destigmatized. There's so much more work to do. I would love to sort of hear, when you released that first book, as somebody who had maybe never written a book before, was not in the arena of self-care and doing all this, did not set out originally to do this, what was the response and how did it feel sort of moving through other people experiencing your lessons and learnings? And I mean, your accidental studies of life and self-care.
Yeah, it was so powerful. Because I thought this is just going to be a hobby. I'm going to be an executive. I want to run this network. I'm on the fast track. La, la, la. That was the plan. And then the book took off in a really major way. I think it was because it was COVID and it was sold in Target and it has I think, the most beautiful cover in the whole wide world.
It's gorgeous. You did a great job with it.
Thank you. The artist, Jess Phoenix, like, she nailed it. And it's what's really important to me is, though I was at Comedy Central, I actually went to school for playwriting, and writing art, that's always been one of my big passions. So I want each one of my books to look like an object of art, to be a delightful thing that you can bring home, that always sort of gives you a little like energy burst. And so I really was like, you know what? It's fine if people judge this book by its cover. Its cover is awesome. The words are awesome. And I think it just hit in a moment where it was COVID. I mean, this literally came out at the beginning of COVID. So it was lockdown. Only the Targets were open. People found the book. And then by word of mouth, they started telling one another about it. And now it sold like over 250,000 copies. It was it was crazy, given that I wasn't anybody, you know? But I think that was the blessing, is because I wasn't anybody, I was just 100% honest. My tone is, I might not be funny right now, but I promise in writing, I'm hilarious. I used my whole comedy background to talk about these darker topics. And to me, I was never embarrassed. I never gave it a second thought about, oh, should I share this? Should I not share this? I was really raw for two reasons. One, there's just a chip missing in my brain, you know, because after it came out, I remember all these fancy executive people are like, oh my God, you're sharing all this? Like, what's going to happen? And I was like, oh my God, something bad could happen. Wait, what? Why didn't anybody tell me? I truly was like, oh, I didn't even consider this. And that was part of it. But then the second part of it was, I was so miserable. My life was so horrific. I lived in constant anxiety, depression, dread. My life was in danger at various times, that I really didn't care. If this story was going to help one other person, then it had to be out there, you know? So I felt so mission-driven. It's like, honestly, it sounds so cheesy, but when I was pitching the book to publishers, I said, this was the book I was put on earth to write. This is part of my purpose. And so that's how I've really pursued this whole self-care thing. Is such a left turn, and is the correct left turn, because now I know, oh, so many people are suffering. They don't talk about it. They hate themselves. Like, hate the things I hear. I'm not enough. I don't do enough. I'm unlovable. I'm ugly. I mean, constant chatter at that level is so painful. And so I'm here to help remind people of their inherent self-worth and their agency, that you have the power to help yourself. You just need the right tools.
I think what you, in sharing your story too, it represents something that we don't often see, which is allowing your story to live and breathe and be told regardless of the fact that other people are involved. I think that a lot of people have a lot of experiences that are very, very, very hidden and tucked under rugs, because there is this notion that we are to protect each other, family, blood. It causes, and for so many people, that's the path that is most comfortable for them, that is safest for them. But in the shock and awe of people sort of being surprised at yours, I think it comes from a lot of this long time, generations and generations of skeletons in closets, and nobody ever sees them, nobody ever learns from them, and there is no progression. I hope it's okay. I ask, do you have a relationship with your parents? Is there, because I know some people have had stories that they've written about their childhood experiences, and it's been a healing journey for both them and their parents together, because a lot of times we forget that like parents are human beings and often didn't have the script and the tools that they needed. And so there can be dual healing, and other people are like, no, there had to be severing in order for us to individually heal. Are you comfortable sharing at all about your experience with that, especially that being a topic in which you write about?
Yeah, for sure. And once you write two books, two memoirs, every question is allowed. There's no question off the table. I put myself in this position very willingly, because This is such a good question. When I was writing the first book and the second book, excuse me, Glow in the Effing Dark, I put above my desk the words vulnerability, honesty, and kindness. Because what I didn't want to write was a slam of my parents. I didn't want to be resentful. I really wanted to come at it from kindness for them, kindness for me, for anybody who appears in any of the books except ex-boyfriends, because screw it, I don't really care. I don't really
Fair enough.
Care about their feelings. But anybody else, I was very sensitive to. And because I get this question a lot, people want to write their stories, even if it's just for them, but they're afraid what somebody else going to think. And the thing with this kind of writing is it's not useful if you don't tell the truth. You have to tell the truth, which means you have to go there and you can have no inner critic. It's purely, here's how I see things. I'm not telling everybody else's story. You know, I don't go into the reasons why my mom and dad might have ended up the way they were. This is my story.
Yes, yes, yes.
You know, and so I wrote my story. And at first, I mean, you really have to just let it go. There's no holding back. And then later in the editing process, you can go back and say, oh, maybe this one I want to withhold, you know, this. But I wrote the first book. I gave a copy to my dad 1 year before the book came out. So I've poured my heart into it. Everything I want to say is in it. I gave him that. And I said, you know, if there's something in here that really bothers you, let me know. My relationship to you is more important than any book. I will take it out. Just let me know what it is. And he read the book and he said, well, this all happened. Don't take a word out. It's the truth. And it was the first time. I mean, I had grown up in a physically dangerous house where things came to die. Not like the plants, the pets. It was an open construction site for 5 years. It was not good. And it was the first time that my dad was forced to confront what really happened. And he even told me, he was like, you know, at that time, I was scared to be in our house. And when I thought about that, I'm like, wow, I was under five. And my dad, who was in his 40s, was scared to be in that house. What must life have been like for me? And it was this big moment of understanding between me and my dad. And it was the first time we started to build a real relationship. Wow. That wasn't just completely superficial. So in that way, the book was incredibly healing for me and my dad. My mom, on the other hand, I've been estranged from for 15 years. She's unwell. It sucks. Trust me, you know, to anybody who's had to make that kind of decision, it's not one you make lightly. And therefore, when people say, I still get this, people say, yeah, but you only get one mom. You got to love her, warts and all. I'm like, yeah, I'm like, cool. I'm so glad that you can't even fathom why someone might do this. That is very lucky for you. I'm really happy you've had that life experience. And you don't know. You don't know, because nobody wants to do that. So if you do, you probably have some pretty good reasons. And now with distance, because she was also physically abusive, there were a lot of bad things, but that really was sort of the bedrock issue. And now with distance from her, I have gained so much compassion for her. Because now when I interact with my best friend's little kids, you know, I'm Auntie Schusty. I'm like their Mary Poppins. They got me like a big black bag and I pull like toys.
I freaking love that. Oh my God, that's great.
I'm obsessed with these little girls and how I treat them. I would do anything for them. They're little girls. And when they yell at me something, I once took, I made one of the little girls, Maya, a bunch of little cheese snacks on crackers, and I ate one, and she screamed at me. She's like, you ate my cheese crackers. I hate you. I can't, you know, she's melting down. And I, like, in my mind, I'm kind of laughing because I'm like, oh, this is not a big deal. But in my household, I would have been treated like I was the devil. This was really serious. It wouldn't have been just my parents were so insecure. It would have meant so much more. And so when how I treat Maya, I realized, oh, if my mom couldn't treat me this way, there was something deeply wrong with her. And that's so sad that that's her headspace, that she couldn't escape it to have a loving relationship with me. I'm awesome. I'm like a blessing to the people in my lives. I couldn't be that for her. Wow. That is so painful. So that forgiveness and compassion did not happen overnight. You know, there's no mantra you can say, no one therapy session. I mean, I'm talking 15 years of really dealing with this stuff to just be able to forgive that, wow, her head must be hell. That's so upsetting. And that she was never free to love. Oh my, like, I can't honestly imagine anything worse. So however she hurt me, she must have been hurting 10 times worse. So in being open and honest about all of this, I've found my grief, but I've also found my gratitude.
Wow, that's powerful. And something you said around, you know, walking away from that relationship and realizing how lovely it is that other people don't know what that would be like to have to do that and maybe not understand it because they had an entirely different experience brings me back to when I went through divorce and I wasn't giving anybody specifics, but my aunt said something to me that has always stayed with me in terms of responding to somebody else's major life decision. And that she said, divorce is not, nobody gets married choosing to get divorced. And that must've been really hard. And she just validated me without any context, without any need for anything more, just the understanding of nobody just does this because they feel like it. Nobody estranges from their parents because it was just, we got in a dinner fight. Nobody walks away from big relationships for no reason. And also, even though you did explore and share your entire, you know, story with people, so other people who are listening who are maybe estranged, like, you don't actually owe everybody an explanation to everything that went on in your life to make that make sense for somebody else who never freaking walked in your shoes and lived a day in that five-year-old's life. And I find that really fascinating how often we do that with each other, where we compare our individual experiences with the experiences of others. I was talking with a friend about this yesterday and around topics of motherhood and around topics of marriage and how people will use the word hard. Like, we all must know what hard is. If you said, you know, as if you were working in a restaurant, you said your job was hard, that might be very different from a teacher who says their job is hard. If you're in a relationship with somebody and you said, you know, it's been really hard with them, that could mean an entire spectrum of hard. So when somebody makes a decision based on their hard, we have to honor it. Like, that's just, I find it so interesting how complex we become around monitoring each other and what we feel other people should make decisions with their life and the path that they walked because we walked a different one. It would be very, I mean, in my experience, I had a really great childhood. I have other relatives who had not so great childhoods. There are friends of mine who didn't have great childhoods. We, you know, I watch them be cycle breakers over and over again, similar to you, friends who have had really, I was going through something interesting that you were saying about like not being parent, being fed, but not being parented. A friend of mine shared with me once about the fact that she used to hang out with kids that their parents were strict with them, because I was talking about how my parents were so strict when I was growing up. And she was like, I used to choose to hang out with those kids because it always felt so nice when somebody cared that I made it home. And I was like, oh my God, my whole shift on how I looked at being a parent too. Like, I'm not supposed to be your friend all the time. I'm supposed to keep you safe. I'm supposed to make sure you make it home tonight. My job isn't to make sure that you have this big free world in front of you. My job is to make sure that you know the path in front of you and that I'm here for you and I'm here to protect you and not be the person that puts you in harm's way. Anyways, that was like such a complete perspective shift. I kind of would love to hear from you in terms of like reparenting yourself. What has that, how does that look now and how do you feel around some of like watching other people have experiences where they had parenting versus like you having to go through that experience on your own. I know this is the basis of a lot of your books and work, but how have you sort of let yourself not get into this bitter, resentful comparison trap of like other people having really great childhoods and you having less of one, or maybe somebody who, you know, healed faster or quote unquote better? How has that experience been for you as somebody who really had to parent themselves?
Yeah, you're hitting on so many of the things that I've been thinking about a lot too, you know, that we think everyone's had the same experience as we have, but it really, no, you're just so clued into your own mind that's a central experience. And I'm going to be really honest with this answer. I am often resentful. I am often bitter. That little thing doesn't go away. But my relationship to those feelings has 180 changed. So, and I think I should start off by saying the books are not just for people who have had difficult childhoods. I think mine was at such an extreme that people can read into it every shade of difficulty, right? It's almost like absurdist, like why comedy or art works. Like it's so absurd that it kind of forces you to think about things a little bit. So the books are read by people who've had amazing childhoods. It's basically for anybody who just wants to fill in some of the holes and wants to let go of some of their emotional baggage, you know, find a more free life. And so for me in that process, I have friends just to kind of, you were just saying something about, you know, a friend who would say something like, oh, I can't believe how strict my parents are. They won't let me do X, Y, Z, Y. In the back of my head, I'm like, cool, because I was out till 4 a.m. hotboxing weed before the SATs and nobody noticed, cared, or like did anything about it. I'm so jealous that you have parents who care. And so now, so at the time, I really didn't know what to do with those feelings for a long time. Now, when I feel like a pang of, oh my God, I'm jealous, you had it so easy, I think about a few things. One is, wow, and I'm really grateful for who I am. There's no problem with me.
Yeah.
Like I've come so far. I know who I am. There's zero chance I waste my life. I've investigated things to such an extreme. I just sort of like reality check myself that there's really no reason to be bitter here. Sure, it was a harder walk, but do I love my life now? Yes, absolutely. And I remind myself, I don't really know, even amongst my best friends, I don't know what they've really been through. I don't know. And so to compare myself is ridiculous. Comparison is always a trap. And I mean this across the board. I don't compare myself to other authors. I know how many books I've sold, but I'm not the one looking at charts. Somebody just, like with my agent, they just tell me. I don't read reviews. I really emphatically am in my own lane, trying to help from my own lane. But the moment I feel myself moving towards comparison, I kind of have to say, wait, do I like my life? Like, am I happy with me? Because if the answer is yes, then this is kind of silly. Like, I don't need, and who knows how I would have, what path I would have been on had this not all happened. You know, like, we just don't know. So my relationship has changed. I have that little ping of resentment and then I accept and allow, oh, resentment's coming up. No big deal. Return to myself. I think the major life hack on all these things is accepting and allowing an emotion we don't want that we find unsavory and then moving off of it. Like if you could do that, then your common denominator on everything is a lot more pleasant.
Yeah, I think I've worked on this a lot over the years because I couldn't figure out why I would be jealous. Like the feeling of jealousy is so uncomfortable and I fucking hate it because it makes me feel like I'm not a girl's girl. I'm not being supportive enough because I'm jealous of something that somebody else got or had the opportunity to do until I realized that jealousy was just a beacon showing me something that I wanted to have that I wish I'd had, that I wish I had the opportunity for. I can make changes to pursue that, or I can deal with the discomfort of that emotion, but I'm no longer going to feel bad and like I'm a bad person because I experienced jealousy. I think that this is why I'm so excited for the new Inside Out movie. I'm so excited for it because I feel like that is truly Inside Out is the movie. And I've said this so many times on the podcast. I'm so sorry for longtime listeners. But that movie really helps you identify the value of each individual emotion and the fact that like we can't just happy everything away. You're not supposed to be happy all the time. You're not just going to have like to your point, I feel like even in the space, like I talk a lot in like body confidence and stuff, but the big thing being like the key component being you're not going to feel it all the time. So how do you deal with the discomfort? How do you deal with comparing yourself? How do you deal with jealousy? How do you deal with, you know, reviews that other people are going to give you on what you're doing and what you're saying? There's a discomfort there. We can't just live our lives running away from discomfort. We have to learn how to navigate having them instead of feeling like we're some sort of less human version of ourselves because we experience things like jealousy or comparison traps and things like that. But I do think you're right in terms of, and I think it's fascinating and very incredible that in a day and age like this where we live in such a validating society that you've removed that as like, that's almost like a boundary for you. I'm not going to read the reviews. I don't want to see the charts. It's great. It's great if people are loving it. I love to hear it, love to see it, but I don't, because it can start to shape you. It can start to shape your story and the way you share it and the way that you react to everything. Talk to me about the second book. What is different from the first book to the second book? And what does the second book really lean into? I love the title of it. I personally went through, the last year has been dark for me. And I think that's hard for a lot of people to hear because if I were ever murdered, people would tell the story of like, she lit up the rooms and she was light and bubbly and so positive all the time. I felt a lot of guilt that I was struggling with suicidal thoughts. I was, and not to mention that suicidal thoughts were not what I thought they would be. I thought it would be, this is how I want to hurt myself and this is what it's going to look like. It wasn't that. It was, how do I make my brain stop? I can't deal with these thoughts anymore. I would do anything to relieve myself of them. And until I saw somebody else, I was reading an article about these types of thoughts and realized that that was a form of it, never would I have identified that. More of like a numbness to not want to live, thinking about ways to stop my brain from continuing thoughts, not that I just want to, like I was, you know, enamored by the idea of anything else. I really like that you titled it Glow in the Fucking Dark, because I feel like anybody who's walked a path with any sort of trauma or mental health, it is, we do it so well. We can mask so well, but it's so fucking hard.
It's really hard.
Talk to me about the second book.
Yeah. So the first book was all about how do you get to level ground? Just, I was so unstable. I hated my life. There was no structure. It was just, I need to know I'm worthwhile, because the chief things I took out of my childhood were, I'm not worth anything. I have no value and I'm unlovable.
Yeah.
And so those were the things that really had to be addressed first. So by the time I had sort of gone through reparenting and written Lilies, I was fine. I wasn't weeping on the streets anymore. I was like, wow, I'm an inherently worthy person and I'm allowed. Life is not a series of crises to endure. It's actually to be enjoyed. Let me try to figure this out. And so I was like, yay, and I'm this author and I did this thing. Huzzah. And then out of, I can curse. You just
curse.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Then out of fucking nowhere, out of nowhere, I get laid off from my job at Comedy Central, where I had been at for 12 years.
I wondered if you'd walked away from it or if it was chosen for you.
Oh, no.
Damn.
I would have never have left that place, because it was, you know, and in Glow in the Fucking Dark, I write a lot about this, but it was like my quote unquote family. It was my safe place. I write about the problems with that. But I'm a millennial. So like all my friends.
Yeah, that's very much the culture.
Yeah.
That's your work family. You've got your work husbands, your work wives. Yeah,
totally.
It's such a culture thing that we thought was such a good thing and then turned out, I mean, they can replace you anytime and your own family can't.
yeah, this is vile. Like, this doesn't yeah. work.
Yeah.
But they laid me off. And what I didn't realize was that the job was a stand-in for my status and identity. You know, I thought, so people had introduced me, Tara Schuster, Comedy Central, like it was my married last name. That's how wedded I was to the job. And it was COVID. I didn't have this job that I had always had. I was an intern at The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, like when I was in college. I really never worked anywhere else. So now I don't have this identity. I don't have any structure. I'm all alone. It's COVID. I don't have a partner. I don't have relationships with my parents. I mean, I was alone. And my worst traumas, the things I really thought I couldn't deal with, my sort of thought was, sure, you can change your relationship to a lot of these things, but your bedrock wounds, I don't think you can really heal those. That was my thought. It was just the better just to like store those away. But when I didn't have the job, I no longer had the distraction. And these traumas really came flooding to the surface. And I realized I have to get right with my soul. I do not know what is at the bottom of me. I do not know who I am when you take away money, success, job. I mean, that's what I was. I had no family, no relationship that was validating me, no money, no job. Who am I when you take all those things away? And I've got to be really comfortable with who that person is. And so glow in the fucking dark, it sounds so grandiose to say that it's a journey to get right with your soul. But it is, you know, it really is. And people, I think we're in a kind of messed up culture when wanting a word like enlightenment sounds so ridiculous and like over the top. It's like, really? Because that's what humans have been trying to do this whole time that we've all been alive. We've all been trying to grapple with, what does it mean to be here? How can you use your life to its best possible ends? You know, all these things. And it's not actually some ridiculously woo thing to do on a retreat in Bali. It's today. Are you living the life you want to lead? Because there might not be a tomorrow. And we all know this intellectually, and then we kind of forget about it so we can move on with our day and get the dry cleaning and buy the bell peppers and make sure they're, you know, nice and firm at the grocery store. Like, we get lost in all those details and we lose the thread that you get one life, the end.
Yeah.
You know?
Truly.
Yeah. So I try to give small tools. So while this is like a big concept, I try to give really small tools that are science-backed, road-tested, that I went through myself, that now people have done my workshops, many, many thousands of people have gone through these. And I give all kinds of tools because I don't know what will work for everybody. Like, I'm not one of these people here saying, here's a silver bullet. I'm like, here are like 15 different things. You tell me what works, because I don't know you, but because there's no one size fits all. And if someone tells you there is, there's snake oil salesman. There's no way.
Yeah, that's something that I think adulthood has really taught me, is like, there's no one right way to do anything. There's many, and you just got to figure out what that is. And kind of going back to that whole comparison thing, really not holding up what our right path is to what somebody else's is, to somebody else's healing journey, and the way that they process through it could be entirely separate from your own. I have one final question for you, because it's something that I've grappled with for many years. As somebody who, you know, has been in those dark places, who has really struggled with all of these different complexities, how have you managed to trust your brain? Because I think when you feel in certain situations that you have everything that should have made you happy, and yet you're struggling with depression, it's almost like we forget that there is so many different factors involved, and you really can't just like paint your life with, you know, a home and a car and, you know, money in the bank account and expect that to, or like the best body and expect that to bring you happiness. But it does feel sometimes like a betrayal of the brain when you go through something like mental health. I call it feeling like when you've gone through something where you start to have these really intrusive thoughts or really disruptive life experiences because of your brain or because of your mental health, you might walk through life like the other shoe is going to drop at any moment. How have you ever experienced that? How have you sort of forged ahead, knowing that like our brains are so complex, they deal with trauma so differently. We can externally and on the surface feel and be one thing, and at any given moment there could be this bubble up of something.
Yeah.
How have you sort of walked through that?
Yeah. In Glow in the Fucking Dark, there's a chapter entitled The Hot Rabbi. And it's not like a rom-com, like Keeping the Faith. There's no Jenna Elfman. There's no Edward Norton situation. It's about my struggle with suicidal ideation. I've actually never talked about this on a podcast before, but since you brought it up, I was dating a very hot rabbi. He was very cute. And I thought in some ways, this is going to bring me closer to God. And he knows all this stuff. And I don't, so then I don't need to. And he sort of questioned my relationship with my mom. He said, you know, the Ten Commandments tell us, you know, we have to honor our mom and dad. Are you really sure that you want to, you know, go against the Ten Commandments? And it led to this really dark moment because I thought, oh my God, am I like the fucking rabbi is telling me this. How bad am I? I'm such a bad person. And we broke up and it spiraled me into my worst depressive episode of my life, where my suicide ideation was so real. It was really like I flirted before. This was the most serious instance of it. And I couldn't believe it because here I am. I already wrote this whole self-help book. I am doing the best I ever have in my life. And I'm fucking crying on this trail, contemplating ways to end my suffering. Because exactly like you said, it wasn't like I was in this melodramatic, kind of place where I'm like so enamored. It was, I have to end the suffering. I feel so bad in my mind. It has to end. I cannot continue to go on this way. And, you know, I made it through that, thank God. And I actually, that whole book, Glow in the Fucking Dark, is just an excuse to write that one chapter. Because I write a letter to anyone thinking, contemplating suicide in the book that I just hope people send to other people, honestly, more than anything. That one chapter is the reason to write that book. But what I've realized is the time to work on depression and suicidal ideation, all this stuff, is not when you're drowning, right? Like you don't teach someone to swim when they're drowning. That's not easily done. The time to work on depression is the moment you're feeling okay. So right now it would be to build a toolkit, because there really are tools. You know, I have a support network. So if I text them the word Louise, which is the diner from my college town, like okay, the greasy spoon, we'd go to at 3 a.m. If I text my two best friends the word Louise, they immediately know, uh-oh, I'm in a dark, depressive place. I probably am not going to reach out. They need to force me to have plans. Like I've made it really easy. I have an action list. Okay, so I'm like that. I text them Louise. I immediately go to synagogue, not because I'm not religious, but because I need to be connected to people. I have to be around people. It will distract me. It will remind me of my belonging. It will help me get off the ledge. And there are other, I write about different kinds of tools to help yourself. But we think I'm fine. I don't need to go to therapy. Everything's great, right? But you don't go to therapy. You should not be going to therapy at the depths of despair.
Yeah, it's so true. You know,
like
it's so true.
Go when you're well, come up with the tools. And also therapy isn't just to quote unquote fix a problem. It's also to help you lead a better life, like a more joyful, like It's not just for a person who's weeping all the time. It could be for a super happy-go-lucky, optimistic person who just wants a richer life. You know, it's not necessarily for problems. So the way I've really handled this is to self-care is not an option. It's not a nicety. It's not icing on the cake of your life. It is the cake. You have to take care of yourself. If you know, and people say to me, oh, but isn't self-care selfish, you know, or they become martyrs about, I take care of everyone else before I take care of me. I'm like, cool. I get that you think that's so great, but the people who make the biggest difference in this world are the ones who are grounded themselves, who have any capacity to be compassionate, to enjoy their lives, to be the person we look at and we're like, wow, I just really like being in her company. She sees me. It's not the super stressed out, brittle, fragile people who refuse to take care of themselves. You know, taking care of yourself is a revolutionary act in a world that tells us we're not valuable. And it's also a way we show A, gratitude that we were born at all, because I'm pretty sure that whatever put us here didn't put us here just to endlessly suffer and refuse to take care of ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd find that very hard to believe, right? But you are a part of your community. This gets lost all the time. If you just consider yourself an island, sure, self-care, then I guess that would be very selfish or just, you know, in one loop. But if you are in any way tied to a single other person, then self-care is always community care because you are in a community and how you act deeply, deeply affects everyone around you. And that ripples out and affects people around them. And so it's really this urgent cause that I have found is we need people to take better care of themselves so that we can, I mean, look out, you know, read the news. Things aren't great.
They're not great. No, you know, not so doing well.
Instead of being so stressed out about it and thinking, oh, there's nothing I can do about this. I have no power. I have no agency. Start with you. If you want to see more kindness in the world, start with you. You don't like the tone things have taken, start with you. We have so much more power than we realize. And it's really time that we start using it and flexing it like a muscle.
I think that's probably one of the most important things I've ever heard in my life is that self-care is community care, because it's so true. And I've had to have conversations with one of my teenagers before that was really struggling with self-care. And I said, would you want this for your sister? Is this what you would encourage her to do with her life? And she was like, no, of course not. Like, and I was like, so why? I need you now. And I was like, I understand I can't force you to have this thinking. So when it goes through that you are making life decisions for yourself, I want you to think if this is the thing that you would want for her, because for whatever reason, you're struggling to see the worth in yourself like you can for the worth of other people. Something ingrained can sometimes tell you that you're not worth it. But I think anybody who is in any sort of community or has to share their care with other people knows that if you're not okay, everybody's not okay. If anybody's ever been around somebody who's not okay, it is not just that one individual that isn't. It is the collective that feels it. And so it is community care. So if anybody listening is having a semblance of guilt for whatever self-care path that they're on, need, or are working towards and doing and spending time on or money on or whatever the fuck that is your... That is both for you and for your community and for your family and for your friends. Like, it is so much more than just you. And I think that we hear the oxygen mask thing a lot. And I think it sort of lost its power in a sense, that the gravity of what is being said. But I think it relates to this is like, we really need to figure that out, because everybody's not okay if you're not okay. Like, that's just, if you're in a network, that's just how it is. Tara, thank you so much. I am such a fan now. I've written down a stupid amount of notes to this, and this episode I think is going to be a really special one for so many people. I'm glad that we went there. I'm glad that we talked about the things that, I mean, we can't even say the words on social media anymore, so I'm glad that we're allowed to just like openly talk about things that people are dealing with. Thank you for that. Thank you for your willingness and your openness. And tell everyone where they can sort of like plug in to find you and find your books. And let's maybe loop over what those two books are again.
Yeah. So if you go to my website, taraschuster.com, S-C-H-U-S-T-E-R, you sign up for my newsletter. You could also just Google Tara Schuster newsletter. And I have a newsletter called A Little Thing That Helps. And every week I give you just a little thing that helps. It's totally digestible, totally doable. And it's a great way to, I talk to people in the newsletter. But the books, the first one is called Buy Yourself the Fucking Lilies. And the second is called Glow in the Fucking Dark. And if you're at the very beginning of your journey, I think Lilies is a really good book. I think they're both good always. Like there's, right, because healing is a forever project. But if you're like, oh, I like what she's talking about, well, which one should I read? Lilies is like you're at the very beginning. Glow is, you know, you've done a little bit and you find yourself on a good enough plateau and you're like, I know there's more here. And the books are sold everywhere. Amazon, Target, your indie bookstore, I'm sure would love the order.
Awesome. Thank you so, so much. And for everyone listening, I'm going to have everything in the show notes for you as well. I hope you had your notepads out for this one or replay it later if you need to hear back some of these things. You're really important to yourself and to everybody else in your world. So please, please, please take care of you. And we'll see you next week.
Well, friends, thank you so much for tuning in and listening to today's episode. For more information on this episode, check out the show notes or find us on Instagram at The Papaya Podcast. And if you loved what you just listened to or know somebody who would, please share it. Simply screenshot today's episode in the podcast app and share it to your Instagram stories. And don't forget to tag us. Last but not least, if you'd like to lend your personal support to the podcast, take a moment and leave a review on iTunes. We would be oh so grateful. Tune in next week for a fresh new episode of the Papaya Podcast, and we'll see you then.